Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And things are exciting today. They really are. But first, we have to disclose and disclaim. The Personal Wealth Coach is not only a rivetingly exciting, painful, and possibly boring radio
Insanity
presentation.
Increasing, yes.
But it is also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisor firm in Salado, Texas. Well, it's sometimes in Salado, Texas, but it's where its headquarters is. And it is no coincidence that the names are the same, and it doesn't protect the innocent, because there probably aren't any. But Jeff and Jake here are the principal advisors there, and they're also the principal voices on this radio program. So, you know, it kind of goes that way. Nothing we say on here should be construed to be investment advice. We don't give legal or tax advice, and this is an educational program. So I think everything we've researched, what we're trying to, what we talk about on here, and we believe it to be truthful, and we've got it from sources that we believe to be reliable, but we don't make any guarantees or warranties. And your warranty and prices may be higher or lower than advertised.
Yes, past performance and
past performance, cover. No guarantee of future return, close cover before striking.
Unauthorized personnel will only be on this point. Wait.
Yes.
Unauthorized.
Yes. Unauthorized personnel only should listen to this program.
Right.
If you're authorized, then you probably... I don't know.
Who authorized you anyway?
What we have discovered is in the municipality of Temple, somebody moved the cheese.
Yes. The exits are all in different places.
And I should warn the business owners and everybody else in Temple, having been in Salado as we went through this drill, they rehearsed everything they're doing in Temple now, but moving the exits around and putting up barriers and shifting things around from week to week and putting orange barrels where you're actually supposed to go and hiding the way that you should go and making you look like you're about to drive off into the mud. All this kind of stuff that's going on in Temple is an intelligence test.
Yes.
And it's a survival test to see if Temple can survive without anybody being able to reliably find anywhere else who are driving on I-35, and we went through that in Salado, and we've now survived it, and we're coming back, so I think Temple can do it too.
Yeah, if you're living in Salado now, just imagine that you're living at Hogwarts.
Yes.
In Harry Potter. All the routes change day to day. When you go to sleep, you wake up, and then you don't know how to get to a place that you've been going to for years, and that's fine. Just think of it as magic.
And it's
either that or you can take, you know, that old character from Sesame Street that goes around and paints signs on things. He puts like the number 6 or the number A or the letter A or something. I think that's how we're getting around in Temple right now.
Yeah, that's it. It's just kind
random
of
signs places that don't necessarily mean anything.
And in some places there's no signs. One of the, as we... wound our way through the newly rerouted rat's maze to get to the station this morning, we actually had to make some turns in some places where there were no signs and no indication that you're supposed to turn here. It's just that, does that look like a good place to turn? Yeah, that looks
good.
Like a good place to turn.
I think it's
turn.
Heading
Let's
the right direction.
It was exciting, and I'm sure it encouraged us to build more synapses in our brain or something like that. But anyway,
yes,
the telephone works in here, we think.
We hope.
So you can give us a call if you have a question, and that's presuming today is Saturday, June 24th, 2017. We're live, and you can give us a call and ask us about anything economic or portfolio or investment-related. And the telephone number is 254-773-1400. And we're working on getting internet connectivity set up in here. I haven't quite got it on mine yet.
Well, by working on it, it's to say we don't have it. We're working on it, hoping that somebody else will show up and tell us what the Wi-Fi password is.
I may actually get one working if I can figure out how to do it, but on this end. via the telephone. So we'll see. And we do have a telephone call in on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air with the personal wealth coach. Go ahead.
Good morning, guys. You know, I have to tell you, you sound like two brothers who just woke up on Saturday morning.
We are.
And found their way down the street to Temple. Anyway, I was wondering, and I'm sure a lot of folks that listened wondered, passing back and forth through Salado during the difficult months, did Salado ever take action against DOT, or is there even the possibility that they could?
No and no.
Right.
That was an easy one.
I know there must have been businesses that were had to put for sale signs out.
Yeah, a lot of them. And it
when the sales tax revenue was going up last year for the rest of the state, ours was still falling into the pits. We basically lost. That's where most of the revenue for the village of Salado comes from, and we lost the majority of that revenue, and we lost. I don't know if there's anybody left at this point. No, I don't think there's a single person left that's a city employee at any managerial level in Salado that was there when this started, because they kept having to cut lay people off, and then they cut salaries, and they basically, it was rough, and we're still recovering. We're still trying to figure out how to reorganize and get things going again.
There's a really good question in the middle of that.
What's that?
What are the rights of a community when transportation's coming through? Appreciate that, by the way. The idea here is that in a litigious community, which is the United States, it's a big community, but a community, we have this impression that if we've been inconvenienced, that we should sue. Well, when the government is the one doing the inconveniencing, a lot of your rights to sue disappear because the government's really you. And it goes the other way around as well. There's very humorous court cases where the city council sues the population of the city, and it gets thrown out because they are part of the population of the city. We are part of the government, and so there's a premise there that makes it very difficult to sue the government. You can do it, but it has to be under certain circumstances of gross negligence in a given area where they're not allowed to have gross negligence. And when it comes to building transportation systems, this is an area where they are, by law, allowed to be grossly negligent. it's one of those weird areas that they're allowed to buy property from someone who does not wish to sell so that the greater good can be served by having transportation. And if you think of the number of millions of people that drive up and down I-35, and then you think of the population of little old Salado, inconveniencing the 2,500 people that live there and making 8 to 10 businesses go out of business for the benefit of millions of people on a day-to-day basis, the laws have been devised to say, sorry, business owners, but too bad, we got to do this. And that's something that goes back to, if you think of the old westerns that you grew up watching, when the railroaders came through, and that term, you've been railroaded, it means, hey, you got to sell to us because the government says so, and if you don't, then we're going to take it anyway. That is eminent domain. And eminent domain is something that is the right of the government to come and take property from private citizens for compensation. This is what makes us different than the rest of the world, is that the U.S. government's required to compensate its citizens for the taking of property, where most governments just take it. Venezuela is a good example of a place that likes to take property and not compensate. And so, having said all that, we're in good shape, and I'm sad that the Salado business people were affected, and I'm sad that Temple is being affected this way, but the long-term benefit of getting the logistics done, getting the highway in place, far, far outweighs it, because there's another community a beautiful little community, every bit as beautiful as Salado, not far from Salado, Holland. And Holland doesn't have I-35 running through it. And the property values are much less. The foreclosure rate is much higher. There are much lower tax revenues as far as sales taxes there. So it's like the thing that benefits Temple and Salado is the highway. It'd be really difficult for me or any jury to understand suing the thing that benefits them because the thing that benefits them is being improved. That's the logic behind why it is that folks don't sue the government over being put out of business for expanding a highway.
And telephone number remains 254-773-1400. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, if you want to contact us via email, Jeff's email is up. So Jeff at TPWC.com. Jeff at TPWC.com if you want to send us an email. Thank God for hotspots on an iPhone.
Yeah.
So we're rocking and rolling a little bit here in this slightly antiquated studio that we're in.
We need to start with what happened this week.
I was going to get there.
All right.
Let's see. The Dow Jones Industrial Averages. The Dow Jones Industrial Average for the week was up a massive 0.05%. The S&P 500 was up 0.21%. I could go on like this. Basically, nothing happened this week in the stock market. Actually, it did. The stock market actually was up considerably more than that, not a lot more, but it was up a couple of percent at one point, and then it went back down because oil slumped, and that's a whole story by itself. And it wound up pretty much where it started, which is the way things have gone the past several weeks, actually the past several months. The stock market around the end of February was hitting new highs. It's hit new highs since then, but basically there's no big surges. There's no big run-ups. From May through now, it's up a bit, which is very, very contrary to the tradition of sell in May and go away. The people who sold in May and went away are probably starting to cry in their beer right now, which makes their beer salty, and I guess it makes it taste better. But the bond market, the same thing. Almost zero change for the last couple of weeks. Gold, almost zero change for the past couple of weeks. You go down the list of things, except oil. Now, oil is in it, is providing some small amount of excitement out there as it continues to sink into obscurity, wherever obscurity is. And there's a lot of discussion going on in the economic community about all that, and we can talk about that at great length. But the important thing is all of the optimistic things we've been saying about the economy looking forward 18 months to 2 years are still in place. We still have very low unemployment, and it looks like it's slightly improving, meaning we have less people unemployed. We have low interest rates. We have good corporate earnings growth in place. It keeps surprising people. We have an economy that's certainly not racing for the stars, but is chugging along probably around 2% this year, the best estimates I've got. Picked up Ben Johnson's, I think it's Ben Johnson, anyway, his comments this morning at Morningstar, and he is pretty much in line with the economists that we listened to last week when we were at
San Diego.
We were at Bank of New York Mellon's Insight Conference when they bring in a bunch of people that are very, very, very smart.
Or at least sound that way.
They use big words.
Right, and that generally means something.
And they complete their sentences, which means they don't do tweets. Generally speaking, they don't do tweets. They write long papers that have carefully footnoted evidence in them and
right.
old-fashioned silly
this
stuff
is,
like that.
This is where there's an overlap between economics and medical research. The economists have discovered the cure for insomnia. It's just an economist talking.
I don't know. I just fell asleep. Anyway, the consensus across the board among the economists that we listen to, and I've just gone from what happened last week into economics, but
right,
is that for the next 18 months, maybe 2 years, and that doesn't mean it ends at that point, but 18 months to 2 years, all of the indicators that they see suggest that unless something massive changes, we're going to see more of the same. Bob Johnson, that's his name, at Morningstar, came out this morning with a, either this morning or last night, I just read it this morning, with an interview where he talked about the at the mid-year, because we're approaching the six-month point now, very close to the six-month point, before the next radio program will be at the six-month point, that the economy will probably continue to grow at an average of around 2% for the GDP. Interest rates are going to stay low. Inflation is going to stay low. It's running around 1.8% right now. GDP is running around 2%. Unemployment, I mean, if you just look across the board, it's sort of like it's kind of a Goldilocks story. I mean, it was just right. It's mm-hmm. just, it's smooth. It's running. There's a host of things going on. And one of the things that kind of jumped out at me from Bob Johnson's comments, in addition to the fact that everything is just is percolating along slowly but steadily, this recovery certainly has been the slowest recovery since World War II. But, and here's the interesting point, it's now past, not only is it well past the average length of time for recovery, it is now well past the total recovery percentage since World War II. If we look at the average percentage, the economy, GDP, is up 18% since this recovery started. The previous, it's up 18.1%. The previous GDP rise during the during the expansion from 2000 to 2007 was about 18%. The one before that actually was a little more. But we have an above-average recovery going on in terms of totality, even if it's been slow. And, again, we've said this before, and I think it's important to recognize, it is the very slowness of this recovery that probably explains its longevity. Of course, there's some other, there's a lot of new things going on in the world, so, and that's one of the things we probably want to talk about today.
Right, right.
That there's new indicators around the world, and some of the old indicators as a result are giving false signals and very clearly giving false signals and have been giving false signals for a long time. So there's a lot of changes. Again, the telephone number in here, this is the Personal Wealth Coach. And if today is June 24th, 2017, where you are, the telephone number is 254-773-1400. And hope you've been participating in this. I hope you're not one of those people that is still waiting for some great. Last year, we thought there was going to, I say we, a lot of, in 2015 and even in 2016, there was a lot of discussion that the world was going to collapse because price of oil went down. Because price of oil went down, traditionally, has been...
Demand dropped.
An indication that the economy is slowing. It's like right now, the price of oil is slumping. It's in bear market territory for the year. It's down 24%. Price of iron is down. And traditionally, that means, hey... Guess what?
People
are
into buying
a recession.
Oil.
Yeah, they're not buying iron. They're not buying oil.
Yeah, we got a call coming in. I wanted to go back to some historical stuff,
okay.
And that would help explain what we're talking about now. But we have a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air. Go ahead.
I was wondering if somebody could explain, if the price of oil is down, why is the price of diesel so expensive?
Good question. And
yeah.
Yes, we can. Do you want to hang up and listen, or do you want to stay on the air?
I'm going to hang up and listen.
All okay. Right. Thank you, sir.
He's going to tell.
All right.
He's going to tell.
There is there are some other factors involved in the diesel area. Diesel, if you look at the price, is down. The price is down year over year, and over the last 2 years and 3 years, it is down. It has staggered back up and back down, but there are some regulatory issues that increase the price of buying diesel. Just a few years back, and for some people a few years is a long time, the Congress said that they had to remove a lot of the sulfur that was in diesel. If you recall, before that, diesel was less expensive than regular unleaded. Well, the refining process got more expensive. It also got longer, which means that the price trends for diesel really separated a lot from the price trends for the rest of gasoline, because it went onto a different system, if you will. There's a different refining process, a longer term to the refining process, which means that the, if you think of it from a business perspective, if you bought a bunch of crude oil, and boy, is that crude, and you need to refine it, it needs to go through a whole bunch of different channels. There's a different process for refining diesel than there used to be. It used to be part of the process of the rest of the refining. Now it has to be done separately, and at least during parts of the time. And in doing so, by increasing the length of time it takes, if you think about any normal business decision, you buy a barrel of oil, it's a certain dollar amount, you start the refining process, you have a number that you have to get to make that initial purchase profitable. And if we have a downward trend in the price of oil, it takes longer for it to affect the end product that takes longer to refine. It's just basically, if you think about buying really nice lumber, but the price of lumber drops after you bought it, you still have to pay charge more for the cabinets or the table that you bought, or you're going to lose some money.
And the price of diesel really is down. We have short memories on these things. Back in 2014, at about this time, diesel was running, on average across the United States, about $4 a gallon.
Right. It's down to
it's about $2.50 now.
Yeah, and in some places it may be up as high as $3, but that is significantly down. What you're seeing, and I think the response, the question was in line with the, you can see day by day the price drop. If you see the price of oil drop, then wait 3 weeks and you'll see it at the pump for most of the gasoline products.
It
may be more like 5 to 6 weeks to see it at the pump for diesel.
So basically, diesel is selling today for about the same price it was in 2005. And if you look around at anything else that you want to buy and try to find something that's selling at the same price it was in 2005, you're going to have a lot of hard work.
Well,
and about
computers are a lot less expensive.
Yeah, I'm talking about a commodity.
Oh yeah.
And so
like
if
sticks.
And if you get it around 2000, it climbed up to $4 around 2011, about this time of year, 2011. And has been, while bobbing around, it has been coming down since. So when we say like oil is down 50%, more than 50% from its price at the peak of the market, well, so is diesel.
Yeah.
And I know that sounds a lot. Now, diesel or for that matter gasoline is not going to precisely follow the price of oil, because refineries, I mean, there's the limitation is we only have so much refinery capacity in the United States or anywhere else. And if there's a higher demand for diesel around the world, as there was for a couple of instances in China, it runs the diesel. And that's a key element here.
China.
And what we want to talk about is we're in a global economy. So if the demand for diesel in China goes up because their power stations start to shut down, then the price of diesel at the local pump will go up very shortly thereafter.
Let's take a step back and decouple ourselves from the present moment. See, I use big words like an economist there.
So. Whoa, decouple our...
Oh, yeah, I know it's hard to even repeat.
I don't know when I am anymore.
What I mean by that is...
Jimmy Carter's president, right?
Yeah, let's look back at history pre-Jimmy Carter. Let's go back to something. There was a good book called The Personal Wealth Coach written by an older bald man that's sitting across from me.
It was life before Jimmy Carter.
But this is a cycle that's been talked about throughout history. It's the first identified an identifiable market cycle. It's called the corn hog cycle. And it's old enough that the corn that they're talking about was not maize like what the Indians gave the pilgrims and what we eat all over the United States and the rest of the world, because the markets hadn't discovered that product yet. The corn, if you think about a peppercorn or any other kernel of grain, that was called corn. So any grain is corn. And when we got to the New World, to North America, we said, well, not anymore. This is corn now. So keep that in mind. So the corn hog cycle, you really nailed this in your book, by the way. And I just have to keep going back to that. Every time I do flip through your book regularly. I don't know if you knew that.
Well, I know a lot of people flip my book into the trash regularly.
Anyway, the corn hog cycle is, you put it in the perspective of a farmer. And he's on his way to market, and he's driving his pigs to market. And he gets there,
back then, driving the pigs to market had nothing to do with trucks or
right.
cars.
Right, it was
you got behind the pig,
hitting them, and drove them forward.
Yes.
So a cattle drive had nothing to do with a four-wheeled contraption, except for some wagons. But driving the pigs to market, pigs were relatively easy to keep close to civilization because you could just feed them their scraps. In fact, in many places in Europe, they just wandered in the street. So driving the pigs to market, and you're looking around at all the other people going to market, and they're doing the same thing. All right, this must be a good thing because everybody's on board. Everybody's taking their pigs to market. Well, that has an effect on the market. If a lot of people are trying to sell, then the price drops. So you don't just feed pigs scrap. You also feed them grain, the corn. And in the process of saying, this particular farmer goes, well, maybe I'm just going to keep the pigs a year because it doesn't make sense to sell them at this low amount. Everybody's prices are down because everybody's trying to sell pigs. So I've got to feed the pigs for an extra year, which causes the cost of corn to go up. So corn prices are going up. Pig prices continue to drop during that time period. And people are going, what's going on here? The pig farmer says, I don't know what to do. So sells his pigs, loses a lot of money, decides to get into corn. So buys more corn to plant that year, which causes the pig price to drop drastically and the corn price to go up. And then the cycle reverses because everybody got out of the pig market and everybody got into the corn market. So the same farmer, a year later, is got his cart, and he's full of grain and corn, and he's going to market, and he looks around, and he must be doing the right thing because everybody else is bringing their corn to market too, and there aren't that many pigs, so for sure he made the right decision. Except now everybody's trying to sell corn. And the cycle continues, because when corn is cheap, by the way, it makes barley cheap, and barley is the one form of corn there, and that made it's things that you imbibe cheaper. And so, obviously, good decisions were made following that, and the pig business boomed again a few years later. The problem with that is it stopped working. It was the most regular of patterns. It was beautiful. If we had statisticians back then, we've got statisticians today and some amount of record keeping from back then. But you could plot it, and it looked like a breathing cycle or the tides, totally predictable. And a lot of people started making a lot of money in it until about the mid-1800s. And technology changed. And with technology changing, you could bring cattle from Texas to New York or London. Cattle from Texas to London at a low enough price to destroy that nice symmetry between corn and hogs. It disappeared. When we're talking about oil, when we're talking about gold, when we're talking about iron, new technology disrupts what we would have considered these tried and true cycles. If you don't understand why a cycle works, then you shouldn't depend on it to exist, because if the why changes, the cycle goes away. It becomes something else.
There is a economic relationship that a lot of people will not, you know, I don't, people my age certainly remember very clearly, which is in the 1990s, there was kind of a rule that became very popular to understand about stocks, and that is, and I can use Dell, for those of you who remember when Dell was a publicly traded company, Dell, which at the time was Dell Computer Corporation, it's just D-E-L-L now, every time their stock split, it rose in value about 20%.
Which really doesn't make any sense, except that it was happening, and it was very reliable.
The corn hog cycle doesn't actually make any sense. That's why speculators were making money off of it.
Right.
But still, what happened is, the reason that Dell would do splits, or any other company does splits, is if you got $100 a share, and back then you had to buy a round lot of 100 shares to be economical, so how many people have 100 times $100? Relatively few. If you split...
Wait a minute. I don't have that many fingers and toes. I'm going to have to figure 100 times 100. I'll get back to you on that.
Okay. So the issue is that it took a relatively well-off person to drop $10,000 on...
Wait, I think I have the answer.
What is it?
$10,000.
Yes. To drop $10,000 on Dell stock for an efficient purchase. So by splitting the stock and taking it back to 50, or you could even do a 4-to-1 split and take it back to $25, all a person then really needed to do was have $2,500, and they could buy a round lot of Dell stock. And so every time the stock split, a bunch of people, I say bunch, a relatively large number of people.
Generally people that hadn't had a whole lot of experience, right, in the stock market.
Could suddenly say, hey, I can buy 100 shares of Dell for $2,500. I can scrape up $2,500. They would buy Dell and the price would go up. Did that make Dell a better, was there something fundamental about Dell Computer Corporation at the time that made it better at $25 than it was at $100? Well, people thought, wait a minute, there's a 75% discount on Dell stock.
Only there wasn't, because they made, you know, if you split a stock, it's the same overall value for the company.
And then,
but that was the perception, that it was discounted.
And then a fascinating thing happened one day.
It stopped working.
The stock split and the price went down. And all of the people who had bought relatively small lots, who now had a lot of Dell shares, got to looking at it and saying,
I can sell these.
Something's wrong here. Something's wrong. My price went down when it split. And then the second time it split and the stock and the price went down, people started selling that stock vigorously and getting out of it. And
it had nothing to do with the overall underlying fundamentals of Dell. Dell was doing great at the time.
It had to do with the fact that a piece of technology changed, and that is, on the New York Stock Exchange, it was no longer a premium charged for buying less than 100 shares.
Well, at least not as high a premium, right?
It really didn't make any. The discount brokers came on board in that time, and electronic transfers started coming on board. And the discount brokers would assemble in competing with each other in a digital universe, a new internet digital universe, could compete with each other. And so one of the first things they did was, when a whole bunch of people are buying or selling a stock like that, they would compile all the buys and sells into round lots so that they could get a discount, and then they were getting a discount on the stock exchange anyway. So all of a sudden, the cost of buying and selling 100 shares was not a significant advantage anymore, which meant that the process that was causing the price of Dell stock to jump every time it doubled disappeared because of new technology. The new technology, by the way, was largely created by Dell. That's the reason I use Dell as an example, because Dell had this direct sale method and caused a price war on computers. And so a lot of people had computers where they weren't calling up their broker at wherever, Dean Witter or wherever they were calling up their broker.
Lehman Brothers.
And saying, hey, I'd like to buy 100 shares of Dell stock, I'd like to buy 70 shares. And then broker would say, you know, if you buy 100, your transaction costs drop. and they'd go for 100 shares. Well, they're not doing that anymore. They were going to, at that time, I think Schwab came into existence around that time, and they were going to the other discount brokers and realizing they were paying a fixed cost per share, period. End of statement. No matter how many shares you bought, you paid the same number of pennies per share to buy. And that change, that technological change, the change in the cost of communication, which is a key element here, caused what was considered to be an immutable cycle that had gone on for over 100 years to disappear. And that's happened again this year.
Right. And it's happened in oil. It's happening in a lot of the commodities because there are a lot of new technologies coming online on how we produce oil. And we've got to play some commercials.
And there's new technologies coming online on how to play commercials.
Yes. So we'll be back on the other side of these commercials. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number to call in here, presuming that today is the 24th of June, 2017, the number in here is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back on the other end.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400. And we have lots of things to talk about. We'd love to hear from you, though.
I think we should wrap up that oil and...
Wrap up oil? That's really...
Yeah, so wrap it up. It's a very slimy, kind of lubricated experience.
I think we've kind of barreled it up.
All right. To wrap it up. Obviously, technology's improved in oil. And if you look at what oil price downturns meant in the past, it meant that people were buying less oil. If you know, you could always tell a recession, one of the reasons you could tell is the price of oil would start dropping. And people would go, well, I guess there's less demand for oil. That must mean there's less economic activity. Now the price of oil is dropping and people are going, look, that means a recession. These are people that have used a technique or a rule without understanding what the rule meant. The price of oil is dropping because technology improved. The price of iron and copper and a lot of the other areas that were limiting our progress forward, we found better ways of getting it. And there are little things like the type of vibrations used to rattle ore out of rocks. Just tiny things, but a lot of them. And it's produced a greater method of getting the commodities out of the ground, which means that they can do it at a profit for a lower number, which causes the price to drop. There's more supply. It's available for a lower figure because there's more competition as well. And that leads to a lot of unrest in the Middle East. And if you think the rule that led to us saying recessions happen after oil price drops or during oil price drops, we used to go and put down little upsets going on in any oil-producing nation. We would take all our military and go and say, stop that. Stop that immediately. You can't take your neighbor's property. You can only keep your own property. Stop doing what you're doing. And we're not doing that so much anymore. Nigeria is a basket case. Venezuela is a basket case. We're not doing anything about it. And 20 years ago, that would have been a cause for the U.S. government to get involved because the price of oil would have gone up drastically, which could have put us into a recession.
There's a little piece of good news out there.
Besides, it's
a little piece of good news. Ever since Dodd-Frank passed and became law, there have been tests run by the Comptroller of the Currency and the Federal Reserve on major banks across the United States or major financial institutions across the United States.
Yeah.
And the objective was to, okay, here is a scenario. This year's scenario, for example, the unemployment rate suddenly jumps to 7.4%. And then spikes at 10%, and which is, by the way, how high unemployment got during the financial crisis. So basically, they said, okay, if the 2007 financial crisis occurred again today, and it did start, by the way, 10 years ago this week in 2007, if it occurred today, how would you do? And they run a simulation based on the bank's reserves and everything they have and don't have, and which loans would probably fail and which ones wouldn't fail. And all of the major financial institutions in the United States this year passed the stress test with flying colors. All of them never descended below their 4% minimum capital. Some of them had as much as four times that much.
Right.
Deutsche Bank, which has been in trouble, actually only dropped to 14.6% on its capital reserves in a worst-case scenario.
And I think which the indicates number isn't that 4%, it's 8% that you're talking about.
Well, now, the 4%, there's a tier... Common equity tier one.
Okay,
is
I'm
a
talking
4%
total
minimum.
Total capital.
Yeah, but the tier one common equity is 4%. In other words, they can't drop below a certain percentage of absolute reserves that are just sitting there doing nothing, and that they can draw on in case of an emergency. And in this case, none of the banks drop below that.
Basically, what the stress test is they say you lost all these loans, how much money would you have available? Would it make it so that if people came to withdraw their assets, you wouldn't have it on hand? And they say there's a certain requirement to have capital on hand for when somebody wants to withdraw funds or when a new loan wants to be given out. We are head and shoulders, probably the rest of the torso and most of the legs, above what we were in 2007. One of the difficulties associated with that is that it's harder to get a loan these days because the capital requirements from the bank are so much higher. They have to hold on to assets that aren't really earning for them. And it's one of the problems with Dodd-Frank is they may have gone way too far on the capital requirements. The Federal Reserve has a good method of saying you're not going to fail. But just because you don't fail doesn't mean that you succeed. And what we're seeing in the slower growth rate, and there's another piece that's involved here, and there's another story, you probably saw that one too, about the number of stocks available to buy.
Yeah.
There used to be about twice as many companies, a little bit more than twice as many companies, available to purchase on the public market. It wasn't that long ago. It was some people might say it was a long time ago. 20 years ago.
Yeah, 20 years ago, they were roughly twice the number of publicly traded issues, stocks.
Certainly not that long ago in terms of the corn hog cycle.
No.
That was a lot longer ago.
But, and again, a lot of those companies were small companies that were called, today we call them micro stocks, and a lot of them were manipulated easily, and there's a lot of, and as regulation is tightened down, a couple of things have happened.
Yeah, they've got it's not just the manipulation externally, it's internal manipulation. The books would be cooked quite a lot more in those companies, and if you think back to Arthur Andersen and Enron and that stuff. That happened in the 2003 era when they were looking at, you know, how do we can call these things earnings when they weren't earnings. So more regulation was put in. And if you look at the graph and you look at those time periods, you see the number of stocks available for purchase on the public market dropped. Now, those companies still exist, or the new ones that have replaced them still exist. They're just not available for public purchase. A lot of private equity groups are buying them, or venture capital firms are giving them money. That hasn't removed the risk. It's just moved the risk to venture capital. And it also has removed the common investor from a lot of the initial startups of company. If you think of Facebook got started and had a lot of money before it was available on the stock market because they got venture capital. Historically, if you you know, historically being through the 1980s and 90s, if you had a company that you thought was going to be great, you would take it public just as soon as you possibly could so that you could get the money to make the company be worth even more. And that's what happened with Dell. It's what happened with Microsoft. It's what happened with Apple. The companies of today don't go public until they absolutely have to, because there's a massive regulatory expense that comes with going public. They have to have a whole series of different types of accounting and audits done, and they have to make sure that the way they communicate with each other and with their shareholders and with the public is very, very rigorously controlled.
And at the same time that went on, by the way, in case you think, well, goodness gracious, I'm missing out, you know, as a person who invests in the stock market, I'm missing out on these wonderful gains that the hedge funds and the venture capitalists are getting. The hedge funds, the Barclays hedge fund index, is up 4% this year. Half
of
that
what,
of the
stock overall
market,
yeah.
And it isn't that they don't have some winners in there. It's not that they're not finding some really good places to invest and continuing to do interesting things. It's that they're failing. They're hitting losing sections of the market more often. And it is an indication that the hedge funds used to jump out there, and because they're very loosely regulated, hedge funds, which is a private equity form, used to be able to get in and take advantage of some areas where regulations prevented the rest of the investment money from going. And then the innovation process kicked in, and now it's possible to buy mutual funds or ETFs in areas where hedge funds historically have gone. And all of a sudden the competition is up and the hedge fund's edge has dropped off. And this is one of the more fascinating things. One of the things that's changing in the market, taking a higher level of risk in a hedge fund is no longer reliably likely to get you a higher return. And again, the prime example can be seen is that in 2016, well, in 2015, hedge funds were up 0.4% on average. In 2016, they're up 6%. In 2017, they're up 4%.
So far this year, yeah.
So far this year. And you can see that the stock market has, the last couple of years, pretty much doubled the return of hedge funds. Just if you just took the broad stock market and you look at a hedge fund, you say, okay, the hedge fund's taking a lot more risk. It ought to do better. And it's not. It's doing half as well. And therein, by the way, is a key element, a key principle that doesn't change over time, and that is taking more risk does not necessarily indicate you will get a higher return. Higher returns involve taking some kind of risk, but it doesn't work the other way. And there's a lot of people who assumed if I take more risk, I'll make a higher return.
Yeah.
And this is not true.
It's not
absolutely
true.
Not true. Telephone number in here remains the same. We're coming to the end of the first hour of the Personal Wealth Coach, but it remains 254-773-1400 if you have any questions about things economic or things that have something to do with investing. We are here on this Saturday, June 24th, to answer your questions or at least confuse the issue fairly thoroughly.
You mentioned iron, so I'm going to throw steel out there, the steel tariff threat. Trump has, the president, has said repeatedly that he is interested in imposing a tariff on steel imports because he believes that China and that other countries are flooding the market with subsidized steel. There's a problem with that.
Yeah, a flood of steel would be really awkward.
Magnets would have a field day.
Oh,
did you see what I
boy,
did there?
Oh, that's boy, oh, boy.
The idea here is that if there's unfair practices out there, we should punish it. Well, I agree with the concept. To put a tariff down on steel broadly without targeting, if you don't do it to a targeted company that you can say this company is subsidized, if you just do it against a whole country, you're going to do it against companies that are doing the correct practices, and there is a traditional response by the countries that you do that against. They apply their own tariffs to your stuff. And then the tariff war begins. And that's just anytime you want to look through history at a country saying, we're going to put a penalty on your products coming into my country, you see the reverse happens too, and then it gets more expensive to sell things overseas or to buy things from overseas, which sounds like that would just make business at home do great, except that our entire models, the steel companies in the United States, use ore that they purchase from other places too. And our whole system is designed on that. So if we're not careful, we can start something that will make the unfairness much worse. And we're about out of time for this hour.
And if you would like to contact us off the air, we are an investment advisory firm that does wealth management for people with higher invested amounts. You can give us a call. We have voicemail waiting on the weekend at 254-947-1111, or
you can reach that same voicemail or real live people during the week toll free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email either of us directly at jeff@tpwc.com
or jake@tpwc.com, which confused the heck out of it because we reversed voices.
Yes. If you go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, you can listen to podcasts, you can read our newsletter, you can look at our made-for-radio faces. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.